Captain Charles Sigsbee's urgent cable from Havana Harbor in 1898 contained a remarkable plea: public opinion should be suspended until further report. His ship, the USS Maine, had just exploded, killing 266 American sailors. Yet rather than rushing to judgment, this naval officer urged caution. His restraint would prove prophetic, as yellow journalists screamed, "Remember the Maine," pushing America toward a war with Spain that would transform the nation into a global power. This tension between presidential restraint and the impulse toward conflict has defined America's wartime leadership since our founding days. What began as a carefully divided constitutional power has evolved into something the founders would scarcely recognize: the ability of a single individual to lead the nation into war with minimal congressional oversight. The founders deliberately divided war-making authority. Congress would declare war, while presidents would command forces once authorized. Having seen European monarchs launch conflicts to boost popularity or distract from domestic problems, they ensured no one man should hold the power to take the nation into war, as Lincoln noted in 1848. This careful balance began eroding almost immediately. During the War of 1812, President Madison, ironically a constitutional architect who had warned against executive war powers, found himself fleeing through Virginia as the British burned Washington. By pursuing conflict without strong public or congressional support, Madison created a precedent for future controversial wars. His predecessor Jefferson had faced a similar choice after the Chesapeake incident, but chose restraint, later reflecting, "The affair of the Chesapeake put war into my hand. I had only to open it and let havoc loose." Have you ever wondered how presidents convince Americans to support wars? James Polk created the template in 1846. After Texas joined the Union, Polk ordered General Taylor to the disputed Rio Grande border, a deliberate provocation that led to Mexican forces capturing Captain Thornton and killing several Americans. Though Polk hadn't received Taylor's report, he had already secured cabinet approval to ask Congress for war upon any Mexican aggression. Polk's true goal wasn't defending Texas, but acquiring California and other Mexican territories. When diplomacy failed, he created conditions for conflict, then seized upon Mexican retaliation to claim they had invaded our territory and shed the blood of our fellow citizens on our own soil. The House quickly approved Polk's war declaration after minimal debate. Though Senator Calhoun argued that Polk's claim that war already existed was monstrous and would strip Congress of its war-making power, the Senate ultimately approved 40-2. This pattern, presidential provocation followed by claims of defensive necessity, would be repeated throughout American history. How many times have presidents framed aggressive actions as necessary responses to threats rather than deliberate policy choices? The Civil War, Spanish-American War, and World Wars dramatically expanded presidential authority. Lincoln acted decisively after Fort Sumter without consulting Congress, viewing the conflict as an insurrection. During the 80 days before Congress reconvened, he exercised unprecedented executive power, proclaiming a naval blockade, expanding military forces, suspending habeas corpus, and declaring martial law in Maryland. When McKinley received news about the Maine explosion, he initially showed cautious restraint. "I shall never get into a war until I am sure that God and man approve," he told his physician. "I have been through one war. I have seen the dead piled up." Yet mounting pressure pushed him toward conflict over what was likely an accidental explosion. By 1950, when North Korea invaded South Korea, President Truman didn't even consider seeking congressional approval. "By God, I am going to let them have it," he declared, following Secretary Acheson's advice to bypass Congress due to rapidly unfolding events. When criticized for this complete usurpation of congressional authority, Truman maintained America was engaged in a police action, not a war, creating another precedent for presidential war-making. The Gulf of Tonkin incident exemplifies the dangers of unchecked presidential war powers. When informed about an attack on the USS Maddox in August 1964, President Johnson immediately questioned whether American forces had provoked it through covert operations he had approved against North Vietnam. Johnson compared the situation to sitting next to a pretty girl and you have your hand on her ankle. You move it up further and all of a sudden you get slapped. Despite highly questionable evidence of a second attack 2 days later, Johnson ordered airstrikes and secured the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, authorizing all necessary measures in Southeast Asia, a vague authorization that became his legal justification for escalating a war he privately doubted. Johnson's private anguish reveals the tragedy. He confessed to Lady Bird, "I can't get out, and I can't finish it with what I have got, and I don't know what the hell to do." By July 1965, he lamented having to call up 600,000 boys, while admitting to McNamara, "I don't think anything is going to be as bad as losing, and I don't see any way of winning." No previous president had pushed America into major war with such initial pessimism. The evolution of presidential war powers marks a dramatic departure from the founders' vision. Modern challenges they couldn't anticipate, nuclear weapons requiring split-second decisions, cyber attacks, and terrorism, have concentrated war powers in the presidency. The September 11 attacks, killing nearly 3,000 Americans, equivalent to the Antietam battle toll, prompted George W. Bush's War on Terror, which further expanded presidential authority through preemptive war and indefinite detention policies. This accumulation of presidential war powers raises critical questions about democratic accountability. Modern presidents can deploy military forces globally, launch nuclear weapons, and conduct covert operations with minimal oversight. The fate of humanity now largely depends on one person's judgment, a concentration of power the founders would find alarming. The stakes are measured in human lives. The War of 1812, 2,260 combat deaths. Mexican War, 1,733 combat deaths, 11,500 other deaths. Civil War, over 618,000 deaths. World War I, 116,000 deaths. World War II, 405,399 deaths. Korea, 36,574 deaths, and Vietnam, 58,220 deaths. The question facing us today is whether we can reclaim the founders' wisdom without sacrificing necessary executive flexibility in our dangerous world. Captain Sigsbee's plea for suspended judgment seems especially relevant in our age of instant information and knee-jerk reactions. Perhaps the most important lesson from two centuries of presidential warmaking is that constitutional separation of powers wasn't merely about abstract principles. It was about preventing unnecessary suffering by ensuring that decisions to go to war required deliberation and consent of the people's representatives. When you hear a president speaking of military necessity or security threats, remember this history. Ask whether we're witnessing prudent leadership or another chapter in the expansion of presidential war powers. In a democracy, the ultimate check on war's terrible cost must be an informed citizenry willing to question authority before the first shots are fired, not after the bodies come home.